This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, May 24th, 2002. I'm Nell Abrams, sitting in for Deepa Fernandez. President Bush signs a treaty in Moscow. Thousands of nuclear weapons will be mothballed but won't be destroyed. The State Department releases its list of terrorist nations and names Sudan as an offending party. And part two of Free Speech Radio News' exclusive interview with Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz. But first, these news headlines. The Pentagon disclosed yesterday that hundreds of military personnel may have been exposed to live nerve and biological agents in a series of tests conducted in the 1960s on board U.S. Navy ships. Simone Sabatini reports from Washington.
The information disclosed by the Pentagon follows an inquiry by U.S. Representative Mike Thompson, who questioned the Department of Defense on behalf of a group of veterans concerned that they may have been exposed to harmful substances. Although at the time military personnel were informed of the risks connected to the experimentation of sarin gas, VX nerve, and aerosolized toxins, the DOD could not tell if other members of the crew were exposed to the chemical agents without the proper protections. Former Assistant Secretary of Defense Philip Coyle thinks that on numerous occasions in the past, the Department of Defense has understood the risks of experiments they conducted after they finished the tests. The Department of Veterans Affairs is now trying to reach soldiers and sailors that could have been exposed and that could be now eligible for health benefits. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Simone Sabatini.
As tribal conflicts in Afghanistan continue to pose threats to the peace effort, the United Nations Security Council has extended, but not expanded, the mandate of the International Security Assistance Force for another 6 months. Haider Rizbi reports from the United Nations.
UN Undersecretary General Kiran Prendergast told the Security Council yesterday that a meeting of senior tribal leaders is in danger of being undermined because of the uncertain security situation. The tribal leaders' meeting, that is, the first phase of an electoral process, is scheduled to take place in mid-June. The meeting has been described as the most important political event in Afghanistan since the formation of the U.S.-backed interim administration last December. Prendergast said certain commanders are known to be loyal to members of the interim administration headed by Hamid Karzai, but he added this does not necessarily make them loyal to the administration itself. Some tribal commanders have referred to Karzai as a stooge of the United States. Some lawmakers in Washington support the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan's view that there is a need for the expansion of the international force in Afghanistan. But the Bush administration is against the idea of any kind of expansion. Currently, the U.S. is not providing any troops to the 4,500-member international force. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
In response to planned new labor legislation that would harshen conditions for the unemployed, Spain's main unions have announced the first general strike against that country's conservative government of President Aznar. Maria Carrion reports from Madrid.
The strike is planned for June 20th, on the eve of the European Union's meeting in Sevilla, which will close out Spain's EU six-month presidency. The unions, which represent over 2 million workers, say that this new labor law is the last straw in a series of reforms that have slowly dismantled social gains made under previous socialist governments. The law, which may be approved before the summer, redefines the term gainful employment. It forces those who receive unemployment benefits to accept practically any job that is offered to them, even if it's located far from their residency, is part-time or temporary, or does not match their skills or experience. The penalty for refusing the job is the loss of unemployment benefits. The 24-hour general strike will follow a similar strike held in Italy 2 months ago in response to President Silvio Berlusconi's labor reforms, which brought 2 million protesters out into the streets. It will precede several large demonstrations planned during the EU summit in Sevilla under the banner Against a Capitalist Europe. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Maria Carrion in Madrid, Spain.
An international whaling commission voted to allow whaling quotas for a Siberian and a North American Indian tribe today after a bitter fight with Japan. Amishan Toft has more.
The United States and Russia came to the yearly meeting of the International Whaling Commission with a proposal to allow three indigenous tribes specific hunting quotas on cultural and subsistence grounds. Under the proposal, a northeastern Russian tribe called the Chukotka would be allowed to kill 500 bowhead whales over 5 years. The joint proposal would also allow the Inuit of northern Alaska 55 bowhead whales and the Macaw 20 gray whales through 2008. Currently, the commission only allows whaling on cultural grounds, banning commercial whaling since 1986. But Japan called the proposal hypocritical, noting the U.S. and Russian opposition to Japan's proposal to allow 4 coastal towns a 500 bowhead quota on commercial grounds. In Tacoma, Washington, this is Amishan Toft for Free Speech Radio News.
And those are the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. President Bush and Russian President Vladimir Putin signed what they're calling a landmark nuclear arms reduction treaty in a gilded Kremlin today. The two leaders proclaimed it would help cement vastly improved relations between the former superpower rivals. But peace activists say the treaty doesn't actually reduce the risk of nuclear war. And they say it will make it easier for President Bush to pursue his space-based missile shield. Vivian Schweitzer reports from Moscow.
The Russian and U.S. presidents today signed a landmark nuclear arms treaty which slashes the two countries' arsenals by two-thirds. At the conference held in the Kremlin, George Bush and Vladimir Putin spoke positively of the new strategic relationship between the U.S. and Russia and of what they call their joint struggle against evil and their desire to avoid the obstacles of the past. The treaty aims to cut the nuclear arsenal of each side from current levels of between 6,000 and 7,000 to between 1,700 and 2,200 over the next 10 years. Though rather than dismantle many of its weapons, the Pentagon will be able to stockpile them instead. Critics respond that if in fact the two countries are now friends, then the weapons should be destroyed instead, as there is concern that terrorists could access them while in storage. Both leaders skirted wound questions, declaring that tremendous progress has been made, and in Putin's words, that it is safer to have stock assembled than with a finger on the trigger. The treaty also allows for either country to withdraw for any reason if they give 3 months' notice. Another sensitive issue is Moscow's ties to Iran, listed in Bush's axis of evil, and a particular sticking point is last year's $300 million a year arms deal signed between Moscow and Tehran. However, Putin points out that plants being built in Iran are strictly for civilian use, and even on this issue, Bush declared that he was sure that the U.S. and Russia will be able to work together. Economic issues were also discussed, with Bush saying that trade restrictions on Russia should be lifted, while Putin said he hoped for the normalization of trade and economic relations and that the businessman mentality between the two countries is much alike. Bush will also be in Moscow tomorrow before he visits Putin's hometown of St. Petersburg. Free Speech Radio News, this is Vivian Schweitzer in Moscow.
In Iraq today, 18 activists from the United States begin a six-day walk across the steaming hot Iraqi desert. They'll walk from the Jordanian border to Baghdad. The walkers call themselves the Iraq Compassion Coalition, and they're calling on the Bush administration to halt any plans it has to attack Iraq. Meanwhile, the Chicago-based group Voices in the Wilderness has just announced that it's organizing more than 100 activists to take up residence in Iraq and remain there in the event of a U.S. bombing of the country. 4 U.S. warplanes shot missiles at targets in southern Iraq yesterday, and American warplanes bombed another site in Iraq on Monday. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Jeremy Scahill reports from Baghdad.
As the Bush administration threatens to attack Iraq on an almost daily basis, the anti-sanctions group Voices in the Wilderness announced today that it will immediately begin the formation of what it calls the Iraq Peace Team, groups of activists who will travel to the country in anticipation of a U.S. attack. Kathy Kelly, one of the founders of Voices in the Wilderness, said in Baghdad today that she believes it's necessary for Americans to interpose themselves between U.S. weapons and Iraqi children.
We hope that we'll be able to form affinity groups of like-minded people deeply committed to nonviolence, both from the United States and the United Kingdom, but also from other countries, and be as effective a presence as we possibly can, ideally to prevent the war from ever happening. But should it happen, we want the Bush administration to know that if bombs fall on children and families in Iraq, they'll be striking citizens of the United States and other countries as well.
The announcement of the Iraq Peace Team comes as a group of 18 activists kicks off a six-day walk across the sweltering hot Iraqi desert. Each of the walkers has received pledges for every mile they walk, with the proceeds going to the pediatric ward at the devastated Basra Children's Hospital. The temperatures in the desert can climb to well over 110 degrees. Still, Kathy Kelly says the walkers are determined.
Walking across the desert is going to be, I think, somewhat of an ordeal in very hot weather. And yet we want to ask people all around the world, and certainly people in the United States, to themselves take an extra step, a step of nonviolence toward preventing the assault that the U.S. administration threatens to wreak upon Iraq.
As the activists walk across the desert, dozens of groups committed to ending the sanctions against Iraq will meet at Stanford University this weekend to discuss strategies for ending the sanctions and preventing further U.S.-led attacks on the country. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Jeremy Scahill in Baghdad, Iraq.
The United Nations announced this week that a new round of talks between the UN and Iraq is scheduled for early July in Vienna. The UN says the talks are aimed at resolving the issue of weapons inspectors returning to the country. The last time UN weapons inspectors were in Iraq in 1998, they left after Saddam Hussein refused to allow them access to weapons sites, saying the UN team had been infiltrated by U.S. intelligence operatives. It was the pullout of these inspectors that ultimately led to massive bombing in December of 1998. Today we present part two of Free Speech Radio News' exclusive sit-down interview with Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz. Correspondent Jeremy Scahill began by asking Aziz under what conditions Iraq would accept a UN weapons inspection team into the country.
Some people, especially in the U.S. and the U.K. governments, are focusing on one issue of the whole picture. The whole picture is the suffering of the Iraqi people. The sanctions, which have been imposed for more than 12 years. What about lifting the sanctions? The inspectors stayed in Iraq for around 8 years. They did not report honestly to the Security Council that their mission had been done and accomplished. If they are back and back to the previous vicious circle, that's not going to solve any problem for the people of Iraq. Secondly, there is one important fact in the whole picture. The American government, with the help of the British government, attacked Iraq a number of times in 1993, 1996, and in 1998, while the inspectors were in Iraq, you see. So the question of inspection is not going to solve the military threats. It might be used, you see, as a pretext, as the inspectors themselves might be used, you see, to prepare the ground for a military attack. So what Iraq is telling the United Nations in the dialogue, come and let us solve the whole issue in a comprehensive manner, by peaceful means. The other aspect of the situation, when we speak about the implementation of UN resolutions, in the basic resolution 687, there is paragraph 14, which speaks about a Middle East free of weapons of mass destruction. Iraq is not the only country in the Middle East. There are other countries in the Middle East. There is Israel. Israel possesses a huge stockpile of weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, chemical, biological, and the Israelis have long-range missiles. Why don't they look at paragraph 14 of Resolution 687 and try to activate it so that the whole region could live in peace and without fear of using such weapons? To single out Iraq in this issue is a biased policy, and it is the product of the belligerent militaristic attitude of the Bush government.
But as you well know, in real politics, the way that the foreign media as well as foreign governments, when they speak publicly, they make the issue about weapons inspectors, and so you as a government are forced to deal with that. And in these current rounds of talks, is Iraq open to the idea of allowing the weapons inspectors to return? I mean, we're talking
In the context of what I said, within the context of a comprehensive settlement to the issue of Iraq, within a context of a comprehensive settlement to the requirements of peace and security in the region, yes, we are party of this region, we are a country of this region, and we would like to live in peace, you see. But when, as I said, we refuse the logic of singling out Iraq alone and focusing in it, because this is a biased policy. This is not a true, honest policy towards creating peace and security in the whole Middle East region.
So are you saying no weapons inspectors unless sanctions are lifted?
No, things are connected, you see. Things are connected, you see. You cannot just tell those people yes while our people are suffering and dying from the sanctions or from the continuous aggression against our country. Our country is being victimized on a daily basis by the no-fly zones in the north and the south. Every day and night there are people who are being killed, who are being injured by the American and British bombing. We cannot neglect all these facts, all these sufferings, and just take what they want us to do alone, regardless of the other important aspects of the situation.
You're well aware, though, of the tone right now in Washington. Do you honestly believe that sanctions will ever be lifted with Saddam Hussein as the president of Iraq?
Saddam Hussein is the legal president of Iraq. He has full support of his own people. So he and his people have the right to lift the sanctions imposed on them. Whether that's acceptable to the United States or not, the United States' position is illegal, it's belligerent, and it's against the humanitarian values and international law.
You're a veteran of Western politics. I mean, you know that system like the back of your hand. Do you honestly believe that any administration in Washington would accept a lifting of the sanctions while Saddam Hussein is president?
I don't have illusions about the policies of the United States, and the United States is not looking after the welfare of the Iraqi people. The United States government is conducting a belligerent policy for its own greedy interests. But we are struggling with all honest men and women in the world against the sanctions.
Correspondent Jeremy Scahill with Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz. The U.S. State Department released its global report on terrorism on Tuesday, saying that Sudan took some positive steps against terrorism, but has not made sufficient progress to be removed from the United States blacklist of terrorist-sponsoring nations. A resolution to Sudan's long-running civil war was often cited as one of the foreign policy goals of the Bush administration. Yet following September 11th, some commentators have detected a greater policy of accommodation towards the Khartoum regime on the part of the United States government. However, in southern Sudan, the years of conflict have left a terrible legacy of destruction and widespread human rights abuses. There remains an expectation of greater involvement and even intervention from the international community. Rupert Cook reports.
A well-armed detachment of around 50 SPLA rebels deploy in the Upper Nile region of southern Sudan. The war between the predominantly Christian southern Sudanese and the radical Islamist government in the capital Khartoum is one of the longest-running conflicts in the world. After almost 20 years of fighting, the civilian population has endured massive hardship and suffering. 2 million southern Sudanese have been killed since the onset of the fighting in 1983. Millions more have been displaced. While outside observers and human rights specialists allege that both sides are responsible for widespread abuses against civilians, many southern Sudanese allege that human rights violations come mainly at the hands of government forces. Niang Chol is a former senior official with RAS, the humanitarian wing of the rebel faction the SPDF.
You start when the Sharia law were introduced in 1983. You are being amputated if you made any mistake. These are actually abuses. We are going to end up with a country of disabled. Instead of punishing you according to your mistake, they generalize the punishment. Amputating people, shooting, all these stoning, and all these are human rights abuses. Secondly, they don't allow the female to interact or to work in public places. They are deprived. They are just kept at home as the second or the third class citizen, as if they are the property of a person. Yes, also the bombing. The government cannot actually go and kill the innocent people who are not fighting. They kill children, women, elderly people who are helpless. Because of this situation, a lot of violations are happening.
For many southern Sudanese, one of the issues at the heart of the conflict has been the Khartoum government's policy of forced Islamization. The imposition of Sharia law and religious persecution are cited as major abuses perpetrated by the Sudanese government. Peter Sott is a senior catechist with the Catholic Church in the Bia State region of the eastern Upper Nile.
The rule of Sharia is affecting Christianity. The other thing is that ever since the independence of Sudan, there has been a lot of imposing of Islam on Christians and converting Christians. Even now, if you are Christian and you go from south to north, you have to join them and become Islamic or they kill you.
Following September the 11th last year, many southern Sudanese expected the international community to refocus its attention on the often forgotten conflict in Sudan and the conduct of the Khartoum government. There is a sense that in the past, the suffering of the southern Sudanese, besides the human rights abuses perpetrated by the Sudanese army and militias, have been ignored by the powers that be. Rebecca Niawade is a traditional birth attendant in Bia State.
Why do you just care about feeding us? You feed us like children, giving us food, while you don't solve the major problem. You just have to end it and give us our own place, and then all the problems will be solved. For example, if two people fight, you can just stop them and take them to court. Why don't you take the Sudanese government to court? You can judge them. Whoever has done wrong can be told so and told what to do instead. You should take them to court and find out what is wrong with Sudan.
After years of suffering and the agonizing attrition of terror, the population is tired of war and the cycles of violence. Yet, as so often, the sense of persecution and abuse at the hands of government forces have, if anything, reinforced their determination to fight on. Mayak Ding is the elected SPLA executive officer for Sobat County in the eastern Upper Nile region.
People of Sabat have suffered a lot because of the war, but we cannot be tired and we cannot give up our guns because we become tired or because we have fought for a long time. We will not do that. We will fight until we achieve our objectives.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rupert Cook in the eastern Upper Nile region of southern Sudan.
Last week, the Charles Horman Truth Project held its 2002 Human Rights Awards in New York City. Founded in 1998, the project supports research and investigations to identify and bring to justice those responsible for atrocities committed during the Pinochet era in Chile. This year's awards commemorated the 20th anniversary of the film Missing and actors Sissy Spacek and Jack Lemmon, along with director Constantine Costa-Gavras. The presentation also took place on what would have been the 60th birthday of Charles Horman, an American journalist killed by the CIA-backed Chilean military during a coup in 1973. Dred Scott Keyes attended the ceremony.
Before being overthrown by General Augusto Pinochet, the democratically elected socialist Salvador Allende had begun to implement what he called a socialist experiment in Chile. Wanting to bear witness to this experiment, Charles Horman and his wife Joyce traveled to Chile, where he soon became a thorn in the side of the Chilean military after conducting an investigation into the murder of the head of the Chilean army, René Schneider. When the coup against Allende occurred, thousands of Chilean citizens and Charles Horman were rounded up, tortured, murdered, or disappeared. Horman's story was told in the Thomas Hauser book Missing and was adopted for screen by Greek-born filmmaker Constantine Costa-Gavras and Donald Stewart. Their account was an indictment of government oppression while at the same time taking a poignant look at the generation gap of the 60s and 70s. The film focuses on the struggles of Charles Horman's left-leaning wife, played by Sissy Spacek, and his strict conservative father, Ed, played by Jack Lemmon, and their attempt to find Charles and gain his release. But they're stonewalled not only by the ruling junta, but also by the American consulate. Ed Horman refuses to acknowledge the possibility that his son's disappearance might be a part of a larger conspiracy or cover-up. But as days turn into weeks, he concludes that he and his family have been betrayed by the U.S. government. Chris Lemmon accepted the 2002 Human Rights Award on behalf of his father, Jack.
I remember him speaking about Missing with great passion. calling it a film that had to be made with a message that needed to be heard. One of the things that most impressed all of us about Jack Lemmon was his integrity in filmmaking. He strove to choose films that would make a difference, that would make people think and reflect upon their own lives and behavior. Oft times he would forego a lucrative and timely opportunity in order to take films that spoke of social relevance and responsibility. Films like China Syndrome, Save the Tiger, Days of Wine and Roses. Films like Missing.
During the Clinton administration, thousands of pages of classified documents concerning the Chilean coup were declassified. But Joyce Horman says many of the critical facts contained in the documents were blacked out.
When the final release came out, we didn't find enough. We thought, at least my lawyer didn't think. I thought we could go back to court, but he said, no, we need a little more. And we decided when we saw so many cases being filed in Chile that it was the first opportunity we had to actually go there and ask questions. So we filed a case in December 2000. And Judge Guzman took on something near 300 human rights cases in Chile. We've had testimony come from Americans who were detained in the stadium, from Chileans who were detained. We found a witness who saw Charles there. And just yesterday and today, they were reenacting the crime against Charles Horman in the stadium to understand the testimony of the people who had been detained there and who were witnesses to and heard the gunshots. And it's an extraordinary thing that hasn't happened before.
Joyce Horman added that the Truth Project started by Ed Horman would continue to fight to uncover the truth of what happened during those dark hours of the coup and who was responsible. Missing is an intense political drama and is part of the continuing cinematic legacy of Constantine Costa-Gavras. He has given us Z, The Confession, State of Siege, Special Section, and Hannah Kay, all right-in-your-face political thrillers that often shed light on military and political repression in various parts of the world, including his native Greece. In accepting his award, Costa-Gavras gave his reasons for making the film.
The system of peace appears. Making disappear people for that period of the human history was a system of governments. There is nothing worse for a family to have someone who disappears. You accept the death of someone because it's part of our lives, but someone who disappears, you spend hours, evenings, days, mornings thinking what happened to him. And also because of Chile, I was in Chile before the coup, I met Allende, I met the system he tries to install. I met a lot of people around of him. Nobody was a kind of bloody revolutionary ready to kill people and to do things that have been done in other places during the revolutions. They were nice people working, trying to change their country.
The award-winning Missing continues to influence new generations of viewers and movie makers alike. No doubt it was a Hollywood film, but a Hollywood film without a Hollywood ending. It is daring, courageous filmmaking and set a standard in challenging and engaging an audience politically. The event ended with a special performance by the group Intilamani, representing the vitality and passion of the Chilean people.
Ya se va para los cielos, ese querido angelito.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Dred Scott Keyes.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and WBAI in New York, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. I'm Nell Abrams.